But don't play with me, 'cause you're playing with fire.
Good morning and welcome to Playing With Fire, Long Island's only food, wine, and lifestyle show. I'm your host, Tom Shortell, and I'm here with co-host, producer, and dear friend, Stu Schrager. Good morning, Stu.
Good morning, Tom. How are you?
I'm really good, actually. We're getting close to the 4th of July, which to me is like hump day in the club business, because I have to do a barbecue for like 1,000 people. And you can imagine what that entails. It's a major pain in the ass.
So this year, 4th of July is very interesting. So I'm trying to remember, and this goes back a long time, in my previous life when I worked for my family business. And I think it was something like, it must have been on, I guess the holiday must have been on Friday or Monday, and somehow we ended up with a four-day weekend, which is very rare. And again, I don't clear.
It was probably on a Thursday or a Tuesday or something.
I don't know why it went, why it worked out the way it did. But this year, 4th of July is on a Saturday.
Right.
4th of July is usually fireworks at Jonas Beach, which it is this year. However, because of the 250th celebration of America, the feds decided that air shows, they wanted to make sure that air shows were 4th of July weekend.
Oh, yeah.
The air show that's normally Memorial Day weekend, which we've had for 20-plus years, had to be shifted over.
Got it.
So
it's a good thing, too, because the weather was terrible.
Yeah. So we're very lucky, yes. Yeah, yeah. So the air show is traditionally a practice day on Friday,
right,
and then Saturday and Sunday. And over the 20 years, there was only one time that it didn't happen that way. And again, Memorial Day is a Monday.
Yes.
So again, usually it's Saturday and Sunday. There was one year where it was bad weather. Actually, during the run, like we were there on a Saturday, and a storm came in, and they said, stop, you know, we got to get people off the beach. So they actually had Monday to have a makeup date.
Uh-huh.
So this year, again, 4th of July is on a Saturday.
Right.
Most businesses have Friday off.
Mm-hmm.
But for some crazy reason, New York State Parks has decided that the air show is Sunday and Monday. Monday is not an off day.
Well, so, will be this year.
Yeah, there's a practice day on Friday.
Right.
Saturday is fireworks. And then Sunday and Monday is air show, which is really, really weird.
Well, you know, I'm a big fan of government. Every time government gets involved, something gets screwed up, you know. So, I think that people will take off for that. It doesn't happen to me, but I understand people have personal days and sick days and all the other stuff that goes along with working. And hopefully it'll get pretty crowded down here. The air show's pretty impressive. You know, I was there last year. It was last year we were there? I was there with you?
Yes,
last year, right? Yeah, it was really impressive. I mean, the things some of those planes are able to do, especially the fighter planes, you know, they stop and kind of like hover there.
Yeah, just hovers.
That's kind of weird to me, man, you know, upside down and whatever. It's just crazy.
And then they're able to gas up an airplane.
Yeah, in the sky.
In the sky.
You know, my goddaughter graduated from the academy, the Air Force Academy, you know, a bunch of years ago. So I went out to Colorado for the graduation. And, you know, they do the flyover at the end where you've seen the picture where all the kids throwing the caps up in the air and I guess the Blue Angels or whatever flying over. Anyway, so I was the day before I was out there and they have a golf course on the campus. So my friend and myself, her father, you know, we went out and played golf. And it's funny about those F-16s or F-23, whatever they are. You know, you hear them coming, you know, because you hear a rumble, you know, and you brace yourself. And when they go over, you still almost jump out of your skin. It's unbelievable the amount of noise they make, you know. I can't imagine being on the receiving end of that stuff, you know, where this guy's flying at Mach 2 upside down and he's lobbing, you know, bombs through a picture window, you know, and somebody's hideout.
Well, when they
hideout.
They pivot up.
Oh, it's crazy.
Like,
yes,
to the
like
moon.
A rocket. Yeah.
And then go.
Oh, I know. It's nuts.
So I like to go through this with you. So the radio station in the years that I've been here, has covered air shows. Obviously, we have music. We've also had golf events.
Really?
So,
and I wasn't invited.
Well, in the day, like the FedEx Cup or whatever, the U.S. Open, we'd actually be on site and do like updates and stuff like that. But what was interesting, so, you know, when you think of golf, it's, shh, don't make any noise.
Yeah.
At least in the old days.
Yeah.
And then you go to the other extreme, which is the Jets, and they're going, boom.
Oh, yeah. You know, golf's funny. I play a lot of golf, and it was a time when I was getting fairly good at it. But I get so distracted, you know. I remember saying to my friend Dave, we were at Montauk on the first tee, I said, today, you know, I'm playing really well. I am going to think about every shot. Don't even talk to me, all right? I'm going to focus like a laser on every shot, and I'm really going to try and get into the 60s, you know, which is the thing for me. And, you know, it's never happened, obviously. But I said, today's the day. I feel good. I'm, you know, Dad, just don't say a word. I'm in my backswing on the first swing of the round, and I spot a mushroom out of the corner of my eye. And I'm thinking, you know, if I took a veal chop and I reduced that mushroom down with some butter, and I was like, I get the attention span of a two-year-old, you know, obviously, right? And it's the same thing when I'm putting, you know. I'll be over a ball, and I'm saying, I got to make this putt. And in my head, I hear that announcer going, well, it's Tom Shortell. He needs this for the Crab Cake Open, you know, to win the Crab Cake Open. It's unbelievable. These guys have the ability to focus so narrowly on what they're doing. And that's why they're good and I'm not, I guess. But, you know, it's amazing to me how you can have that kind of concentration. Because I'm all over the place. I can't, you know, and I don't drink coffee.
I am too. I find the same scenario with bowling. You know, 10 frames is a long time to concentrate. So when I'm past the sixth frame, I'm like.
Plus, you have to wear other people's shoes. I don't want to play a sport where I have to wear other people's shoes. You know, just, I don't know. It just seems wrong to me. I don't know.
So tell me, this past week out at Shinnecock was the U.S. Open, I guess it's called.
Yes, yeah.
Were you out that way? Did you get any reports from people how crazy it was out there?
Yeah, I got reports. Somebody told me they didn't sell quite as many tickets as they thought they would. I mean, I'm sure they sold a bunch, but the problem out there is it dead ends there. It's really congested, and it's hard to, you know, if you live east, you're screwed, you know, trying to get west. At least, you know, trying to get east, you know, to the thing, they had the train, they had the two lanes, you know, blocked off or whatever. I've been I've played Shinnecock a couple of times, but I went to, not the last time, the first time they had the Open there, I guess it was about, I don't know, 15 years ago, whatever it was. And, you know, golf and football is the same way. Those are the two sports you're better off watching on television because you see more, you know. You got the instant replay, you know, with the golf, you got the line going, following the ball, you know where it's going, you know. When you're there, you hit it. They hit it so far, I can't see where it's going. Plus, I lose the ball in the air, and it's like, you know, it's crowded and people bumping you. It's not for me.
I have no idea where the ball's going if I'm at a golf course watching.
Yeah, no, it's I mean, these guys, you know, they've taken this game to a level that very few people will ever visit, you know. But it's really interesting to watch them. You know, well, you're standing next to the, you know, a guy who's hitting the ball almost 400 yards. It's crazy, right? But the bottom line is you can't see it, and you can't see what he's going to do next, because then you got to run up and you got to walk with him, and it's crowded, and there's people standing in front of you. I don't know. It's just not for me. I'd rather watch it on television.
Well, the traffic out there in general, I know that I believe they call it the trade parade.
Yeah.
If you go out there, like, I'll leave here 6 o'clock in the morning to go out to, like, Baiting Hollow or something. I get caught up in that parade, and there's a lot of traffic, and that's 7 o'clock in the morning, 7:30.
It starts from about 3 miles before, 3 or 4 miles before the Shinnecock Canal, and it goes right through. You know, I hit it yesterday. I had to do a seminar over at Southampton College, which is kind of funny because I didn't go to college. But so it's the same thing. I get there, you know, I get to the exit. I was coming down from Riverhead area. And I get to the exit onto 27, and it's backed up already. And it took me probably, I don't know, 25 minutes to go 3 miles. And the other way, of course, is going, you know, and you're looking at the other way going out and go, envy these people. And it turns out I get done with this seminar around 12:30, and now it's backed up the other way, you know, going out. So I had it both ways. It took me almost an hour and 45 minutes to get back from Southampton, which is usually about an hour hour and 10 minutes at best. So, yeah, it's just, there's no, you know, there's no good time on Long Island to travel anymore. You know, you used to go into the city between, like, if you waited till after 9, and you could get into the city in 40 minutes from, like, where I am in Oyster Bay. Now, there's no good time. It's bumper to bumper every time you go there. It's nuts. And, you know, I always wonder, don't these people work? You know, I mean, where is everybody going at that time? It's just crazy. Well, I think we're overpopulated.
So it's funny. I was down at Jones Beach for a concert Tuesday night.
Mm-hmm.
I went to see
James Taylor.
James Taylor.
Yes.
And our friend Mike Dorio was down there. But you would think that there would be communications, because usually 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock at night on the, I guess it's like the Wantagh Parkway leading down to the theater, there's no traffic. So you want to do construction, you want to close things down, fine.
Yeah.
But on nights that you have 15,000 people leaving and it's everybody at a standstill because it has to go down to a single lane,
mm-hmm.
it doesn't seem to make sense.
Yeah, I've been saying this for years that, you know, I don't know why they don't do road work from, you know, like midnight till 8 in the morning or 6 in the morning, whatever. It's bizarre. I mean, you know, and there's construction everywhere. It looks like they're building a brand new Sunrise Highway out from Riverhead to where Shinnecock is in Southampton. It's just cones and people. And you know, it's the same thing. You see these guys, you know, 9 guys and 1 shovel, you know, kind of thing. Everybody's standing around drinking coffee, directing the other guys. One poor guy in a hole, you know, digging. And this 9 guys looking at him, telling him, you know, how to dig. It's just hilarious to watch. But anyway, that being said, hey, I went to my old friend Joey Morrow's place. Tuesday, whatever. And, boy, they're doing a great job there. Morrow's and Carl Place. You know, we went in there, and he lets me bring wine in, so I brought him a bottle.
And what restaurant is this?
Morrow's. Morrow's and Carl Place. It's an Italian restaurant in Carl Place.
And where is it located?
It's right on Westbury Avenue.
Oh.
Yeah. And it just, I guess it's just west of Cherry Lane, you know, that the big intersection, Carl Place is a square mile. How big can it be? But the main intersection in town is Cherry Lane and Westbury Avenue. And he's on Westbury Avenue, just west of Cherry Lane, on the north side of the street, if it matters. But it's like a little Italian red sauce place, but everything is executed really well. And Augie, the owner, is just one of my favorite hosts. You know, he does such a great job. He's enthusiastic. He's, you know, fun to be around, enjoys wine and kibitzing. Is that how you say it?
Kibitzing
with people. It's my Jewish side coming out. And just a great experience. We had some baked clams, which were textbook, and a burrata, which was nice. And then I can never eat a whole pasta. We split this pasta. It was like what people call a vodka sauce, which annoys me to no end. That's just the name of it. And had some crumbled Italian sausage on the top. It was really nice, though. It was really good. A lot, though. I mean, if you're a fan of a lot of food, this is the place for you. It's way too much for me and Val. You know, we split it, and I think she still took some home. But, you know, let me just say something about vodka sauce while I'm on the subject, and I'm getting angry. I never understood the name. I never understood why anybody would put vodka in a red sauce to begin with. Because what they do is they put it in the pan and then they flame it. And the only redeeming thing that vodka has is alcohol, you know. It's basically flavorless. I mean, I know I'm going to get some people saying, I know the difference between, you know, whatever, you know, Stoli and whatever the vodka is these days. I don't drink spirits, so I don't really know. But, you know, basically once you put that in tomato sauce, I promise you, you can't tell me which one it is. And so I don't get why you do it. I mean, you could do the same thing with water. Anyway, so they call it vodka sauce. But in Italy, that type of sauce is called Becchia Vitola, which is how I prefer to, you know, talk about it. Because first of all, it sounds better. And second of all, you know, it doesn't have vodka in it anyway for the most part. But I don't know if he had vodka in the sauce or not, but the sauce was really good. So, and then I went to my granddaughter had a softball game over in East Hampton last week, So she finished up around 7:45, I guess it was, and we were looking for a place to go. And my daughter said, well, let's go to lunch. You know, they opened up another lobster roll place over in Southampton.
Yeah, I heard about that.
They took over the diner that's on, right there on the corner where you make the bend on 27 to go to, I guess it's Wainscott in East Hampton.
And that's where the diner used to be?
The diner was right on the bend there, you know. And so lunch took it over. They call it lunch. It's the lobster roll took it over. So we went in, and my grandson's a character, you know. He wouldn't tell us what he's going to drink. Now, my granddaughter saw the mocktails, you know. She said, I'm going to have a Paloma Loma or whatever it was, you know. And my grandson said, oh, I know what I want, but I'm not going to tell anybody. Okay, don't tell anybody. So the waiter comes over and says, what can I get you to drink? He goes, I'll have the fountain soda. He doesn't realize that it's a process. It's not a flavor, you know. Anyway, we had a kick out of that. And so I ordered, I'm in a lobster roll, right? So I'm going to have a lobster roll. So I ordered the mini lobster roll with a side of soup or whatever. It was all very good. I mean, they do a good job there, you know. It's a fun place to stop if you, especially if you have kids, you know, you got a pretty big menu, you got a children's menu, whatever. So a lot of fun. Good stuff.
That's pretty funny. I'll have the fountain soda.
I'll have the fountain soda. It's classic, you know. You wound up with a cherry Coke, I guess, or whatever.
So, being out in Southampton or whatever, how close is it to where you they live?
Well, they live in Jamesport, my house in Jamesport.
Oh.
So it's about an hour to East Hampton. I took the ferry over. It's a nicer ride, you know. I'm a water guy anyway, so I'd rather ride on a ferry for, you know, it takes the same amount of time. You don't save any time, but it's more pleasant. You're not stuck in traffic and PO'd, you know. But I miss East Hampton. I lived there for a long time, and you know, I moved because it got so kind of weird, you know, aggressive and entitled and, you know, whatever. And so I finally got out, but I do miss it. I miss, you know, and I saw Roman Roth the other day, you know, when I did that seminar over in Southampton College. Roman Roth was there. He's the owner / winemaker at Wolfer Vineyards. So, you know, I miss my friends out there. I have, you know, my band is based out there, guys that I know. My golf partner lives in East Hampton, you know, so I have, you know, stuff out there that I don't get to see as often as I would like to. But it was great to be back there, you know. It's just East Hampton, if you avoid July and August, is maybe one of the most beautiful places I've ever been. You know, just that's why so many artists live out there. You know, you have the light is different out there, you know, the smells, you know, in the fall, everybody's got a fireplace. It's gorgeous. It really is.
Well, it's funny that you mentioned the ferry and stuff. I know every so often Carrie and I will take the ferry up to Rhode Island. Obviously living on the South Shore, but in the middle of Nassau County, it's a little bit of a ride. But
right,
Carrie's
yeah.
sister lives out that way. She lives in Aquabog.
Yeah, yeah.
So we're usually journey out there, sleep over, and then take a morning ferry when we're doing that.
Mm-hmm.
But I always do get a kick out of the ambiance of the area driving, you know, along, I guess it's a Montauk Highway, as you go out to Orient Point. I mean, it's just so scenic. And
yeah, that's 25. Yeah, it, you know, the East End bit me early. And to me, I don't know, did you ever... You know, I don't want to get into this whole karmic discussion, but do you ever feel like, you know, it's the first time you got there, you've either been there before, you belong there for some reason? You know, it was the same thing. The first time I went to Montauk as a kid, I was like 17 or something. And a friend of mine, we drove out there and we were going to go fishing for a couple of days. And I just got there and I said, this is where I belong. This is where I'm meant to be. I don't know what it was. It was just the place was just gorgeous. And you know, the entire East End is like that. It's kind of, it's more like New England than New York. I think it has more influence from New England than it does New York. I mean, the houses, the clapboard houses, the designs, the whole vibe is more, you know, Massachusetts than in Cape Cod than it is Long Island and Fire Island. It's just a gorgeous place. And now what they're trying to do is they're starting this group called Savor the East End, and they don't want to define it like North Fork and South Fork. They want it to be called the East End, which is, you know, a food and wine thing for sure. But they're starting this group now that what they want to do is they want to, you know, let people know that the East End is a destination not only in the summer, you know, which is when most people go there, But year-round, there's all kinds of art. There's museums out there. There's plays going on out there. There's wineries out there. The restaurants are open year-round, you know.
Yeah, I think there's the West Hampton Performing Arts Center.
They have that. They have Guildhall. You know, Guildhall's been here since the 30s. They have Bay Street Theater.
It's a little, I guess, further west, but the Suffolk Theater has a lot of nice concerts.
Yeah, yeah, that's Riverhead. Well, this whole East End thing, this Save the East End thing, starts, I think, somewhere around Mariches, and then it goes, you know, to Montauk and Orient. And they just want to be known as that, as the East End, not as the North Fork, South Fork, or Riverhead, or whatever. And, you know, we'll see what happens. I've been through these things before where a bunch of people get together, have a good idea. You know, we're going to promote, everybody's going to promote each other, and we're going to get it going. And then one guy didn't like that idea, and the other guy says, my idea is better than yours. And then there's infighting, and it just blows up, you know. We'll see what happens. I mean, Roman's a pretty level-headed guy. They need a director, though. He was talking about a part-time director, and I'm like, I don't know. I think a full-time director is what you need, because you need grant money. You know, you need all this stuff to advertise it and get it going. And, you know, other than trying to get it to be 80 degrees in January out there, I don't know how you're going to get people out there in the dead of winter. You know, I've been out there, you know, since I'm a kid. On and off, and I can tell you, you know, winters have gotten better, but, you know, they're not, everybody's, oh, it's busy year-round. Yeah, on Saturday, you know. You know, try running a business one day a week.
So, update me. Over the years, we had a friend, your friend, but I call him my friend, who was a retired fireman that had a vineyard out east.
Jimmy Waters. Yeah. Yeah, he's down in North Carolina now. He's working in a golf club. I guess he gave up making wine. You know, we talked about this yesterday. I talked about this with a guy at the seminar. And he was saying, you know, wineries are changing hands. And, you know, every time you turn around, there's a new name. I'm like, yeah, the wineries, they're like restaurants. They're hard to run. They're labor intensive. You don't make a lot of money. You're dependent on the weather, you know. A friend of mine said, he's got the greatest quote I ever heard. He goes, you know, winemaking is a business that's, how do you put it? Oh, your partner in, you know, winemaking is a partnership between the winemaker and Mother Nature. And unfortunately, she's the senior partner. You know? And it's true. I mean, you know, the last 2 years, 24 and 25, were maybe some of the best years for wine growing on the North Fork. And hopefully it'll be a hat trick this year, you know. But, you know, they're constantly watching the weather. They're constantly, you know, quivering in their boots, you know. And the thing is, you get, it's essentially farming. You know, winemaking is farming. And, you know, the winemaker's kids, you know, don't, you know, after, you know, helping out on a farm, you realize this is not all bright lights and glitter here, you know. And maybe I want to go to law school. And so they don't want to take it over. And what do you do?
So Jimmy Walters... Waters vineyard, what did it become?
It wasn't a vineyard. He was a négociant. He used to buy grapes. He would buy grapes from everybody, make
process them.
Yeah, his winery was in a strip center of all places in Kutchuk. And, you know, he had a garage door in the back, and, you know, he could load stuff in there, big tanks.
Yeah, now it's coming back to me.
Yeah, yeah. He's a good winemaker, Jimmy. Better reds than whites, for sure. But, you know, his wines are good. You know, he was a talented guy. He still comes up every once in a while and makes wine at Roanoke, you know. Roanoke Vineyards, he helps Richie out there. But it's hard work, and it's, you know, you've been in Total Wine, right?
Yeah.
I mean, look at the labels. I mean, it's thousands of labels. I mean, your competition is insane, you know? Everybody makes wine now. I mean, you know, and you know, how do you get that shelf space? How do you get that placement? How do you, you know, it's hard. And you know, the thing that's not unfair, but it is what it is, it's not cheap to make wine on Long Island. It's like living here, you know? I mean, you can't do it on the cheap. It's the same thing. Labor's expensive. Housing's expensive. You know, you got to put these people somewhere. The land's expensive. You know, it's like California. I was talking to a guy when I was out there. He said that real estate in California, in Napa, is $2 million an acre. That's crazy, you know? And the guy that I was talking to bought 3,800 acres. Mm. So that's what kind of money you need to be in the wine business. You know, this guy was the Bill Gates of Japan. You know, he made all his money with gaming and, you know, whatever they do with the Street Fighter or whatever. But anyway, it's a very, very rich man's sport. It's like horse racing. I mean, you know, very little reward. It's an ego thing for sure. You know, I mean, I make my wine at Pominac. I don't make any money on that. I mean, you know, it's a vanity project. It's all, you know. I have my name on a bottle. I get to make the wine.
And what happens with the wine that you produce?
I use it basically in the restaurants. I mean, it's for sale at the vineyard if you know me. And I give the blessing when you go out there. They'll sell it to you. But that's basically mine for me. You know, it's basically sold through the restaurants. And I have a little bit of a private stash of my own, you know, which I keep. I just took the last case of 2010 Merlot that I thought we were out, and we found a case, so that's mine. But it's more fun than, you know, I was never looking to make any money with it. You know, I pay them generally what I would pay them if it was their wine, you know. Because they make it, they vinify it, they label it, they do everything for me, so they deserve to get the money, you know. Could I put a VIG on that and sell it to myself? Yeah, but it's like taking money out of my left pocket and sticking it in my right, so it doesn't matter, you know. I'd rather just, it's easier to just do it this way.
So here we are, again, essentially July 4th weekend, which is next weekend, actually.
Yeah, please, not too soon.
But so we're talking about how the East End has nice wine products, but what are the other virtues of the East End as far as fruits and vegetables?
Well, I was just talking about this yesterday with Florence Fabricant, you know, the writer for the Times. She was at the seminar also. And she got started writing a column for an East End magazine or newspaper or whatever, all because she was saying, I'm standing there in the supermarket and I'm watching these people buy these, you know, big red blobs of you know, flavorless tomatoes, when, you know, 40 yards down the street, there's a farm stand with people selling these ripe things that they grew in their backyard. And I think she was so right. I mean, she started, you know, unbeknownst to her, a farm-to-table movement with her her writing. And then, you know, 6 months later, she's writing for the Times. It's a real kind of, you know, what you call those stories, you know, rags-to-riches kind of story for her. Her writing, anyway. And I think that's what, you know, the North and the South Fork, let's call it the East End, because I've been committed to that now. I'm a founding member of the Savor East End, right? Which, you know, it's funny, you get these honorary positions, you know, it costs you $1,000, but it's an honorary position. And I think it's the farm stands that, you know, that literally litter the East End. I mean, you have, I don't know, there's got to be 30, 40 of them out there, you know? And you know, if you watch, the interesting thing about immigrants is, I did some work in Chinatown years ago, and I did some study in there. You know, the people shop every day at these little orange bags. They go to, you know, the grocer, and you know, they pick up the bok choy, spinach, or whatever you're using, and they'll go grab a fish or whatever, and they get these bags every day. You know, we shop once a week. You know, the grocery store load up on everything, you know. But, you know, you can shop every, you know, especially vegetables this time of year. I mean, the corn, the tomatoes, the zucchini, you know, it's all out there. And, you know, there's literally a farm stand every 2 miles, you know what I mean, on 27 and 25. You know, there's a tremendous amount of beautiful vegetables out there at this time of year.
So the thing that comes to my mind is corn.
Yeah.
So for whatever reason, I get served a lot of ads on Facebook, and I'm truly not a big social media guy, but mm-hmm. I check Facebook somewhat.
Yeah.
And there's a product that essentially, it's like the scraper that you use to get your inspection sticker off your windshield.
Yeah.
And it's like a long handle, and you're supposed to like rake the corn off the cob.
Yeah.
So it's funny. I guess you could find a special tool for everything.
Yeah.
But to you, who probably does this all the time, because I'm sure you're making corn relish and different sure. corn products, how do you get the corn off the cob?
I use a knife. Just, you know, the key with taking corn off the cob is to do it in some kind of a container so the corn doesn't bounce all over the counter, and not to be greedy. You know, if you go too deep, you're going to get that.
That's so
that
funny. I was just going to say that I'd probably be too greedy because I want to get as much as I can.
Yeah, no, it's like filleting fish. Sharp knife and don't be greedy. You know, because otherwise you wind up with a bone in your throat.
Wait,
you know?
So I have to divert just one quick second. I was out to dinner with some good friends last night, and he lives 6 months, 7 months out of the year down in Florida, and then he's up here. And he's showing us a picture of a pineapple that he grew.
Uh-huh.
And I guess they got harvested while he was away, and he had his friend cut
pineapple
it up
thief.
And eat it for him. Now, I said to him, this is ridiculous. If it's your pineapple and all your efforts and you're so proud of it, that's what FedEx is for.
Yeah.
Like, get it back up here, yeah. You know? But I'm totally confused, and I didn't do any research yet. But how does a pineapple grow? Does it grow on a bush, on a vine?
Yeah, they're very low to the ground. The bushes, you know, they're very low to the ground. I don't think they're more than
He made it seem like it's like a carrot. I mean, above the ground.
Yeah.
But he made it seem like that, and I'm saying, I never knew that.
Yeah, I've been, you know, in pineapple fields in Hawaii, and it's, yeah, they're very low. And, yeah, and really one of nature's gifts to us. I mean, it's just, pineapple to me is fabulous.
And then I blew his mind because I said there's pink fruit. Pineapples, and he goes, no.
Oh, yeah, they're right.
And then I showed him a picture, and then, where do I get that?
Yeah.
So a shameless plug for Stu Leonard. Leonard usually has pink pineapples.
Yeah, they're expensive, but they're great, you know. And really, they don't taste any different. It's just it's the romance of the color, you know, they get you. But corn, you know, corn to me is, there's a lot of people that are freaked out about it, GMOs or something, you know. I'm one of those people that, you know, yeah, okay, pay attention to some of that stuff, but you're not going to get out of this life alive. You might as well have some fun, you know?
So you were just saying that the pink pineapple might be a little more sweet or something.
I don't know about that. I mean,
it tastes the same, you're saying?
Yeah, it's pretty much the same.
So my question then quickly goes to peppers. Mm-hmm. There's red, there's green, there's orange, there's yellow, and maybe there's more. But do they have different tastes, or is it the aesthetics when you're making a dish?
I think the green has a different taste. You know, it's, you know, bell pepper is one of the things that you, one of the, what would you call it, one of the flavor profiles in Cab Franc sometimes. Some people can detect green pepper. It's more prevalent in California Cab Francs than it is in France or Long Island. But and it can be kind of a little off-putting, but that green pepper thing, there's a rawness about it that the other peppers don't have. To me, red and yellow taste the same. Orange probably the same thing. I don't use too many of those. But the green pepper has a much more of a pronounced flavor, I think, you know. And then you get into, you know, all the other the peppers. They're interesting as hell. You get the Italian long peppers, and you have the, you know, and then the whole chili section, Fresnos and chilies and jalapenos.
Well, I keep saying it's called shishito.
Shishito, yeah.
And
can you say that on yeah, it's very close to being, you know, boop. You know what's funny about shishitos?
And
only 1 in 10 is really hot.
Well, yeah, that's where I was going. So, like, how do you usually roast those and salt them?
I saute them.
Saute them.
Yeah, you can roast them. That's fine. But they go quick in a saute pan, you know. And then I just finish them, you know, however. I mean, sometimes I leave them alone with a little salt and pepper. Other times, a little bit of soy sauce and some chili flake or whatever. But they're fun, sesame seeds, you know. They're great because if you're not a pepper person, if you're worried about heat, you can get through them. And you'll get one every once in a while. But they're not like a jalapeno where you're going to really get lit up, you know. They're not really that hot. But they're fun to eat. And they're a good garnish. They're great with steak, you know. Steak and shishito.
So we were just talking about the peppers and coming in different colors. There's a couple of different varieties. And again, some people are into peppers because of the heat that they carry with them. When you get to mushrooms, there's all sorts of varieties of mushrooms.
Sure.
And do they all have different tastes? Or
they
is
do.
It, again, the texture? Or?
Oh, it's all the above. I mean, you know, if you have morels, which is one of my favorites, they're much like woodier, or I don't know what the right description is, but they have much more of a mushroomy flavor than, let's say, cremini, you know, which are mild, you know, or the button mushrooms, which really just, they're like water, you know. It's like same thing with lettuces, you know, lettuces, same thing, you know, you get, you know, iceberg and arugula, you know, has that bitter thing.
So if you're putting mushrooms in a salad, which would seem to be a, you know, a go-to thing, do you prepare them, or are they raw? Do you saute them?
Doing both ways. I mean, the Italians make mushroom salad where they slice them really thin on a mandolin and serve them with a little, like, vinaigrette or whatever, you know, raw. I prefer them cooked. I think it brings out more flavor. I don't think the mushrooms have a lot of flavor when they're raw. But, yeah, you can do either or. I mean, there's raw mushrooms in salads. You know, there's people that just eat raw food and, you know, have that whole movement.
And you just said when they use the mandolin to slice up the mushrooms or whatever. So, again, you are my foodie guru, and you've convinced me that sake is best drank cold rather than warm. And I find that a number of times they serve the sake with shredded cucumber.
Yeah.
And what's the deal with that?
I don't know. It's to me, it's unnecessary. Sake, I don't know how we got from mushrooms to sake, but we got sake to me is as serious as wine. I mean, it's, if you've ever delved into it, and I've only been really into it for about 6, 8 years, 10 maybe. I didn't drink much sake before then. I don't drink a lot of it now, but you know, you have sakes that go for hundreds and hundreds of dollars a bottle. You know, so this is real serious winemaking, because sake is essentially wine. It's made of rice, but it's wine. And, you know, it's like, would you take a, you know, California, like a Chardonnay, let's say cake bread, you know, is probably a name that everybody knows. Would you put shredded cucumbers in your cake bread Chardonnay? You know, or would you put, you know, mushrooms in your Camus Cabernet Sauvignon? To me, it just seems silly. I don't know why they do it. Maybe it's a Japanese custom. I don't know. I mean, I've seen it done. You know, they always bring me a glass with, you know, that little sake glass with the cucumber in it.
Yes.
And I always say, can you take that back and just give me a wine glass, because this is what we're drinking here? And I don't know if you've ever really gotten into some high-end sakes, but they're absolutely gorgeous. I mean, you know, some of them taste like mushrooms, some of them taste like mangoes, some like lime. The amount of different flavors that they get out of rice is insane to me. I mean, I don't know how they do it. It's crazy. And again, I mean, I have some sake in the restaurants that, you know, I sell for $200, $250 a bottle. It's like a very fine wine, you know. I don't sell a lot of them, admittedly, but we have them. And they're just gorgeous, you know. If you have that kind of ammunition and you want to take a shot, you can't go wrong with them. They're just fabulous, fabulous stuff. But as far as the cucumbers go, I don't know. It's like warm sake. It's like, why would you do that? I mean, most of the warm sake is just, that's like the, you know, the Gallo Hardy Burgundy kind of, you know, class of wine. It's just not very good.
So you're talking about different grades of sake and stuff. So I sit on the board of directors of the Nassau County Police Reserves, which is an organization of business people supporting police and their families. Mm-hmm. We award scholarships to children of police officers, and when there's traumatic or economical scenarios within a police family,
we'll
make a donation.
Good stuff.
But a lot of the people I sit on the board of directors with all have residences somewhere out on the East End, starting with Quag and going deeper.
Yeah.
But in that area, is there a – and they talk about this lit wine shop that's, like, very popular. And I'm just familiar – is there, like, a go-to wine shop out, like, in that area or
– there's a bunch of them. I mean, there's Four Corners. I think that's in West Hampton. There's Franay in East Hampton, Race Lane in East Hampton. They have some serious wine shops out there. You know, you're in wine country, so obviously there's going to have, you know, better wine shops. I mean, there's, you know, what's funny about, it's really weird that you could be in a wine area, wine country, and not find the local wines on lists in the restaurants out there. It's like we're in the only self-hating wine region in the world.
So that's an interesting, that went above me. I'm listening to these guys talk, and they all talk about, you know, they belong to dining clubs and this and that, and you know, you get the privilege of buying something if you're a member, but sometimes you're auditioning to be a member, and you can just dream about being participating and stuff. But that's the question to ask. What are the wines that they're enjoying? But I'm led to believe that a lot of it is California stuff, and they talk about the different vineyards and about, you know, knowing which one to go to, because you don't buy, they don't sell it retail, but if you're
Club member.
So is all this, I guess it would be snobbiness?
Wine is a snobby hobby. I've met people over the years that just, you sit there, it's an eye roll, you know, when you hear them talk. And the funny part about it is there's some wines on the East End that are as good as anything made anywhere in the world, you know. And for whatever reason, most of us refuse to believe it. We just absolutely won't believe it. I don't care. You can give me proof. You can make me taste it. I ain't doing it. No, you know. And it's just weird to me. It's like, what do you got against this? You know, when I buy wine, and I buy a bunch, right, for myself and the restaurants and all that, I'm looking for artisans. I'm looking for people who work the vineyard. I'm not looking for this formulaic 1,000-gallon tank stuff that they have a recipe for, that they put the juice in, they add this, and a little bit of that, and it's trying to make it the same every year. That, to me, is a beverage. It's not wine. Wine, to me, has to have dirt on your hands. You got to have, you know, mud on your boots. You got to have, you know, dirty clothes. It's just, it's farming, man, you know? I want the guy that's out there in the field working it, checking the bricks levels, looking at the sun, worrying about the weather, all of that stuff, you know? Anybody can buy, you know, I'll use Camus as an example. I mean, to me, Camus was a great wine in the 70s and 80s, you know? I don't think it is anymore. I think it's just this, you know, and that's just my opinion, and, you know, people drink it and, you know, it tastes fine or whatever. I'm looking for something different. I'm looking to taste the terroir. I want to be able to say where that's grown, you know, or say, you know, Jimmy Waters, you brought up before, we had an interesting conversation one time. I came back from France, and I was at this vineyard in Languedoc, and it was loaded with sheep. There was sheep all over the place, right? And I pour him. I didn't show him the label. There's actually a sheep on the label, a lamb or whatever. And I poured him a glass, and he smells it. He goes, Jesus, that smells like sheep, you know what? I'm like, bingo, you know, you got quite the nose there, homie, you know? But that's, it reflects where it was grown. I mean, that's kind of what I'm looking for. I'm looking for something that's real and organic, and not organic, you know, by definition, but real and, you know, from the earth, and the guy that worked it, and the guys that destemmed it, and the people that crushed it, and the people that bottled it, and the guy was in there blending it, not some, you know, computer-generated recipe. And, you know, you see a lot of that. I mean, to me, the California cabs, they're fine. You know, you want to drink them, drink them. I get it, you know. But they kind of all taste the same to me. They're all chasing that Robert Parker 100 rating. And they all kind of fell into line, you know, to try and get that rating. And I get it. It's economics, you know. But I don't know. I'm always looking for something different, you know, just something more interesting.
So let's backtrack in the calendar, or on the calendar. We just talked about corn that is very seasonal, and now's the time, and you savor that.
Yeah, you got about 2 months, you know,
so
it's over.
What are some of the other things, like back in April, that, you know, you're sitting at the Easter table or whatever, and you're saying, you know, before you know it, summer's here. You know, spring's about to sprout. Summer's almost here. What were some of the things that you look forward to? I know soft shell crabs is something that you always talk about.
Yeah.
But what else this time of year? This and especially from our region.
You're talking about now or the spring?
Now.
Oh, Well, that was corn, tomatoes, lobster, you know, basil. Those are the big.
But how is lobster seasonal?
Well, it isn't really, but we're getting the ones that are from around here now. The waters have opened up, you know. Most of the year it's Canadian. But, yeah, I mean, it's not seasonal but in the sense of, you know, they're not around in the winter. It's seasonal in the sense of this is when you want to eat them. I mean, you don't want to go to a restaurant. I mean, maybe you do, but you don't want to go to a restaurant in January and order a lobster and have the, you know, like I always say, the butter dripping off your elbows. You want to do that. That's a summer thing, you know. It's a summer thing. It's an outside thing. It's a on-the-deck overlooking-the-water thing. I mean, that's personally when I want a lobster. I mean, you know, the rest of the year, if I'm doing lobster, I want to do it out of the shell on the plate with a cool presentation, and I don't want to have to mess with it. But I think if you took, you know, like I make a pasta with lobster, corn, tomato, and basil, and I think those are it's the holy trinity of, summer eating, because tomatoes only have from now until probably September, and then corn is over. You know, you can tell corn. You can tell when corn is getting old because when you sauté it, gets brown right away. That's when the corn is starting to go. To me, that's the first indication that, you know, okay, it's time to check that box and get it out of here and bring in something else, because it's over. But the corn this time of year is just phenomenal, and it gets better and better as you get through July and August.
So you mentioned lobster, and I called you on that. Our good friends at Jordan Lobster Farms over in Island Park had a fire.
They did.
And they're closed. And talk about a void in the marketplace.
Yes, yeah.
And, to all the employees as well as the ownership, I hope that you're able to quickly come back into the and enjoy the season. I mean, there's nothing better than, as you say, you know, partaking in a lobster and having it drip all over you.
Oh, it's the best. It's the best.
But so just in lobsters real quick, while Jordan's was before the fire, I had a wealthy friend that, you know, sort of was boasting that, you know, I go and get, pound chicks because it's more economical. To me, unfortunately, it's almost like eating a shrimp.
Yeah, but you got to eat three of them, so it's really not that economical.
So, but he went the way of saying, oh, I was at Jordan's recently and we had a 6-pound lobster. And my question is, like,
it's a lot of lobster.
Is that the way to go, or is it better just to go with the 2, 2.5?
To me, 6-pound lobster is, you know, overdoing it. I would reward him for living that long, for avoiding the traps all those years. You know, you just let him go, you know, go gently into the night somehow. I don't know. I people always say the bigger ones are tougher. I don't really believe that. I think it's just the way they're cooked. You know, the bigger ones tend to have huge claws, and so by the time the claws are done, the tail's overcooked, you almost have to take them off and cook them separately. But I think, you know, a 2-pound lobster is a nice size. You know, it cooks pretty evenly. It yields a fair amount of meat, you know. And, it's somewhat affordable. I mean, when you get up to them 6-pounders, you know, it's going to be, a little bit of a price shock. But, I think that the bigger ones, they're generally not cooked that way. So you're going to have chewy meat, I would think, in the tail. You know, and plus you need a hammer and an anvil to break the claws.
So a 6-pound lobster is brought to you at a table. Do you go to the claws right away?
Me? I don't know. You need a construction. You need a sawzall to get through them, you know, because they're thick, you know. So I probably start on them and trying to
it's
break
funny
them up.
When Carrie and I share lobster, for whatever reason, I let her. I donate the tail to her, and I'll enjoy the claws and the body destroy it.
I had a friend who used to eat like that. She was great at she would extract all the meat out of the little claws and stuff. It would take her like 3 hours and 40 minutes to finish a lobster.
So thanks to Gillis, I was able to have Father's Day. My meal over at Bryant and Cooper.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
Good for you.
He on the way out, he said, Stu, if you ever need anything, you know, give me a holler.
Yeah, I need a discount.
Just appreciative that I was able to get in for Father's Day.
Yeah.
But it was interesting just the way you were talking about, attacking a lobster. They had, I guess, king crab legs on their menu.
Yeah.
But before I get into that, you talk about prices. Again, nothing against Bryant and Cooper because it's just the market price.
Sure.
What's the big steak? The
Waterhouse?
No, the
Tomahawk?
The Tomahawk. $300.
It's a lot of money.
But at any rate, a table next to us was having king crab legs, so the waiter comes up, you know, like in his surgical garb.
They're like $300 too, those
things. Instead of, I guess, you know, breaking it down at the table, he breaks it down at a carving station.
Yeah, carry it done.
But it took like 20 minutes. My mom was just fascinated.
Yeah.
And she goes, you know, that's going to be cold by the time.
Yeah, he's not good at it.
It gets to, but no, so that's the question. I mean, king crab legs, is that something that's like, not room temperature, but, you know, we talk about soup and you can't get it hot enough, or at least as you get older.
Yeah, the older you get.
So if again, the king crab legs are brought to be served, and then the waiter is breaking it down, deshelling it.
Yeah.
Is that bad if it takes a long time because it's not hot, or needs to be warm?
If you're over 80, it's bad. If you're under 80, it's okay. I mean, you know, crab meat can be hot or cold. I mean, you know, it's
yeah. Because if you get crab cocktail, it's like a shrimp cocktail. It's course, chilled. Yeah.
The problem with king crab legs is that they're super expensive now. But if you've ever watched Deadliest Catch, you know why. I mean, it's, you know, people risking their lives to get these things in, you know. I don't know. To me, it's not. I think blue claw crabs are way better. To me, the meat's sweeter. It just and soft shells are, you know, God's gift to crab eaters because you don't have to worry about the
but
shells.
But if you are doing the king crab legs, dip it in butter. I see people, even if it's, well, I guess a lot of times the king crab legs are chilled. That's where you get it. But
yeah.
So people would tend to use cocktail sauce. But if you're getting it like warm, king crab leg.
Yeah, the butter's fine, you know. It's like lobster, you know, if you like it. I mean, I was talking to my grandson. We were going over to the softball game, so I'm on the ferry. And we passed the lure, you know, on the way out there. He goes, oh, you know, Paco, I don't really like the lure. I'm like, why? He says, because there was butter all over my lobster. I'm like, well, there's a complaint I haven't heard before. You know, I said, it's unique. You didn't like the butter? No, I like butter. I just don't like it on my lobster. I said, well, why didn't you just say something? I would have, you know, got it off.
Dry it off.
Know, you know, I didn't want to bother you. All right. So he hates the restaurant now.
So I don't remember. I know it's on the menu, and I know my mom fancies it. The small claws
the Jonah crab.
Is that what it is? And it's very, that also is tends to be expensive.
Oh, but you're talking about the stone crab claws.
Stone crab.
Yeah.
There's like a special sauce people dip that in.
Yeah, mustard.
Mustard?
Yeah, it's a mustard sauce. Again, it's, you know, that flavor, stone crab flavor is very, very mild. You know, once you dip it in mustard, it's you basically, you should have had a hot dog. It would have saved yourself a fortune, you know. Yeah, stone crab claws. The interesting part about them is, you know, you're only allowed to harvest one claw because they regenerate.
Oh.
Yeah, so when you take stone crab, they grab one claw, and then he can only eat with the one.
At the risk of bastardizing the language, remoulade sauce?
Remoulade. You're getting close. You're getting close.
How do you say it?
Remoulade.
Remoulade. Yeah. But isn't that also a sauce that people use with crab legs?
Yeah, you use it for a lot of stuff. You know, it's pretty versatile in that way. But yeah, as far as the king crab goes, yeah, it's very good. And the great part is the meat is usually big, you know, because the claws are so huge. But they're like, I don't know, $70 a pound or whatever.
And then my mind goes to, where did Old Bay seasoning come from?
I don't know. I don't know.
But isn't that like associated with seafood in New England?
Yeah, it's in everything. Yeah, it's kind of an odd spice too. I mean, you know, it does add an interesting flavor if you don't use too much of it. You know, if it's a suggestion of Old Bay, it's pretty good. If you pound it in there, it's awful. You know, it's just salty as hell too.
So we're talking seafood. So I went to Bigelow's in Rockville Center.
It's still open?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And I was on my way to my mom's, and I offered her the opportunity of having something there. She wasn't into it that night. But I couldn't go by without getting some chowder. So I go in there, There's obviously New England clam chowder.
Yeah, yeah.
There's Manhattan clam chowder. And then there's Long Island clam chowder.
Nice. How was that?
Which is a mixture of the two
red
chowders. Like, is that sacrilegious to
it's light
you?
Light pink? Is that what it is?
No, actually, what it seemed to be was that they, like, first put in the New England, so you have the creamy soup, and then they put in the Manhattan, so it sort of goes in the middle, so it's almost like a stuffed soup. But and then the question is, you know, should you? I didn't get into
should
it.
Should you mix it?
Should you mix it, or you should be like, you know, delving into each section of
it's complicated. Yeah, I would just mix it up and hell with it. You know, yeah, it's I do a what we call a New Island chowder. You know, and it's a cream base, but it's made with fennel, saffron, and orange. So it's a little bit of a different flavor profile. But they're fun to make. I love making soup. Soup is, to me, is one of the most fun things you can make and eat, by the way. You know, especially the chowders, especially this time of year. You know, we're talking about summer. I mean, what's better than a bowl of clam chowder and a crispy baguette? You know, it's just fabulous stuff.
Not the little crackers?
No. I don't like the oyster crackers. I think a little piece of bread with olive oil or butter on it. Well, listen, we're getting to the end here, Stu. We got to get out of here.
Tom, time flies way too quickly when you and I chat.
I know. I had no idea. So we'll have to say goodbye, and we're going to do that with Tom's Three Keys to Life, like usual. His life is too short to drink bad wine. Treat every meal like it was your last. Keep chocolate in your life as important as sex and pizza. And start packing up those coolers for 4th of July barbecues. We're going to have a lot of fun this weekend.
Everybody, get ready for a treat. It's time for stepping out for something mighty good to eat. You looking for atmosphere? Well, they got it happening here. They're doing barbecue the way it ought to be. Bring your sister, brother, significant other. Bring all your pals. There's always something smoking at Smoking Al.
It's spring and summer is right behind. It's time for Smoking Al's party catering menu. Make your next party at Smoking One with Al's Ribs, barbecue meats, chicken, appetizers, and a whole lot more. Try Al's new fantasy platters in the comfort of your backyard or one of Al's party packages. The weather is heating up and the party is smoking. Smoking Al's, Massapequa Park. For details, call 516-799-4900. And remember, there's always something smoking at Smoking Al's.
There's always something smoking at Smoking Al's.